Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring one of the most consequential and disturbing chapters in modern history, the rise of the Nazi regime in Germany and what it meant for ordinary Germans. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. From the ruins of the First World War and the fragile democracy of Weimar Germany emerged a movement that transformed German society, plunged Europe into catastrophe, and unleashed a genocidal war that claimed tens of millions and lives. But as we'll see, the story goes beyond one of dictatorship and terror, and it's a story of ordinary people, the choices they had to make, cultural change, propaganda, resistance, and the erosion of democratic institutions. A new search engine has just been released that allows users to search Nazi party records in order to find out whether their ancestors were card-carrying members, and it has been accessed millions of times since it was launched a month ago. So we will discuss that as we explore why so many Germans supported Hitler and the Nazis. And to help me do that, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Nick Stargardt is Professor of Modern European History at the University of Oxford and is a fellow at Magdalen College there. One of the leading historians of Nazi Germany, his books include Witnesses of War and The German War, A Nation Under Arms, 1939 to 1945. I'm also delighted to be joined by Katja Hoyer, an historian, journalist, visiting research fellow at King's College London and fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And her brilliant new book, Weimar, Life on the Edge of Catastrophe, has just been published. Well, you're both very welcome. And also, I suppose, just to flag for our listeners that some listeners may find some of this discussion, given the subject matter, upsetting. Well, you are both very welcome. And Katja, I might begin with you and I might begin with your wonderful new book about Weimar. And I wonder, why did you choose Weimar as the lens through which to examine Germany during this period?
Well, I think a lot has been written about this whole period already. So I was trying to find a new approach to it that would be less kind of abstract and less top down, if you will. So I wanted a particular place and a particular group of people that I could follow through the interwar period. And the more I looked into this, the more I realized that actually the town of Weimar itself, where the Republic was founded, which is why we still call it the Weimar Republic today, has a lot of that history happening right in the town center. And so basically, apart from the Republic being founded there, you've got the modernist art and architecture movement, the Bauhaus, also founded there in 1919. And then later on, it becomes a very early Nazi stronghold as well, with Hitler visiting over 40 times and developing a very personal relationship to that town. So it seemed a good place to me to go to, because the people there basically saw history right in front of their doorstep.
And it very much is a town on the edge of catastrophe. And well, first of all, maybe why was Weimar chosen rather than Berlin?
So Berlin wasn't particularly safe in 1919 when the first post-war elections happened, and also when the first parliament was supposed to sit together to try and decide what this new post-war Germany should look like. So they had to sit down somewhere to draft a constitution. And in Berlin, you had communist uprisings, upheaval. Those were brutally crushed by the so-called Freikorps troops, so basically former World War I veterans being unleashed onto those workers. And that's really not a place to kind of sit down and have a great think about how your country should look like in the future. So they were looking for other places. And Weimar quickly appealed because A is right in the center of Germany. So that logistically and symbolically, that seemed a good place to go. But more importantly, perhaps Weimar is really highly associated with German culture and literature. So it's where important poets like Goethe and Schiller lived and worked. Composers like Bach and Liszt spent a lot of time there. philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche, it's deeply associated with a more civilized and cultured Germany. And so that appealed rather than going to Prussia, again, of which Berlin had been the capital. They basically wanted to take it out of there and go to a place that was associated with a different kind of Germany.
There are some wonderful characters in the book, and one of them is a stationery shop owner who initially, I think, was drawn to the Nazis because of the economic circumstances and the repeated challenges that his businesses had. And then as time went on in the 1930s, he became increasingly uneasy.
Yeah, he was an interesting vehicle for which to explore sort of what the lower middle classes thought and felt. Because as you say, he's a shop owner, Karl Weyrich is his name, and he moved to Weimar in 1914, just on the eve of the First World War, not knowing that that's what the time was. And to me, what's interesting about him is that, you know, he didn't move to Weimar and set up a shop in 1914, expecting that 20 years later he'd live, you know, in a totalitarian dictatorship. So, you know, it's interesting to see how his thoughts and attitudes sort of develop over time and how he also gets used to certain things like the extreme violence, for example, that surrounds the Nazi movement. And as you say, initially he was sort of putting his hopes in the Nazi party, not being a particularly ideological person. So he never actually joins the Nazi party or any other political movement. He just sort of tries to keep his shop afloat. But then the situation does get so desperate after the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression that followed it, that suddenly you find this line in the diary that just sort of says, and now we're putting all of our hopes in this new young chancellor called A. Hitler. And I thought at that point, you know, having followed his story, that completely came as a shock to me, as a surprise to me, because he isn't particularly political. But he also becomes, like many Germans, I think, a little disaffected already by the time that the sort of late 1930s kick in. And certainly once war looms on the horizon and Hitler's making noises towards another world war, which I think a lot of Germans approached a little bit more warily this time than they had done in 1914.
And he never joins the party, but he does support the movement, it seems, financially.
Yes, so he becomes a so-called supporting member of the SS, which was another sort of huge shock to me to discover that. So this basically meant that he wasn't an active member. He didn't have to actually kind of put on a uniform and join them that way. But he did make financial contributions, which was just a symbolic value of 1 mark a month, for which he got a magazine and a sort of membership number. And I think that was a sign that initially he did put all his hopes into the movement and wanted to support it somehow, even if it was very modestly. But he also leaves that again just a few months later, and as I say, never joins the Nazi party. So he's in many ways an example for the complexities of that time and of the things that I was trying to show with the book, in the sense that, you know, most people moved somewhere in the grey zone between complete support for the NS regime and the sort of other end, you know, resistance fighters, of which I also have a few in the book, but they were really far and few between.
How much did he know about the Holocaust? Because he certainly seems to have been uneasy about some of the persecution of Jewish people as the 1930s went on. But there are always these questions about how much people were aware, how much they thought about what was going on, or really how much they ignored it.
Yeah, so one of the things that makes Weimar such a fascinating sort of microcosm is that it also has a huge concentration camp right on its doorstep in 1937. The Nazis built the Buchenwald camp literally just on the outskirts of Weimar. And Karl Weyrich, my bookbinder, who forms the center of the book, he does carry on kind of going hiking and sledging very close to it, as most Weimarers did. It was up on a hill, the Ettersberg Hill, just outside of the town. And that had been a kind of favorite, you know, place to go on Sunday outings for Weimarers. And they don't stop doing it just because there's a concentration camp up there. So they do know it exists. I found evidence of children in Weimar sort of taunting each other and saying, you know, if you don't behave, you'll end up in Buchenwald. The knowledge of it was that common that it even sort of stepped into everyday language and culture. And there were also rumors that, because initially Buchenwald didn't have its own crematorium, and so the bodies that were very, very quickly racking up in the camp were taken down to the town itself and burned in the normal town crematorium right in the town centre on the cemetery. And there were rumours going around that one of the lorries that was taking the bodies down had sort of tipped over on the cobbled streets and the bodies were supposed to have tumbled out. And whether that's true or not, the fact that people were telling each other those stories, I think, tells you a lot about how much they knew. And yet when the Americans turn up and they basically liberate the camp and decide that it's so horrendous what they find there that ordinary Germans need to see it, they take 1,000 Weimarers up to the camp and show it to them. And Karl Weyrich is one of them, the bookbinder. And I think there still is genuine shock there on there. You can see it in the footage as well that they've taken, because I think what happened was that they were able to somehow push that out of their minds, the actual realities of it. They saw people being beaten onto, you know, lorries and taken up there. They knew what it was, the camp. But to imagine the, you know, the piled up bodies, the horror, the evidence of torture that took place there, I think that they closed their minds to it. And that's the only explanation I have to that. And Karl does write in his diary, for example, that he is appalled by the so-called Kristallnacht, the November pogroms in 1938 against Jews, and calls it blasphemy. He's deeply religious, and that's sort of the most moral most moral terms of condemnation that you can find, to call it sort of blasphemy against God himself. That's what he wrote in the diary. But nonetheless, he doesn't help his only Jewish neighbor either when she gets attacked, an old Jewish lady running a toy shop of all things. So I think most people, as I say, lived somewhere on that continuum between not being entirely convinced that it was right what was going on there, but equally going along with it.
And Nick, that contradiction is really at the heart of how we understand German reaction and responses to the Holocaust. And it does seem to be an open secret, with people aware to varying degrees about what was being planned and what was happening.
Absolutely. So we now know, in fact, we've known for about 30 years, as people started publishing collections of secret Nazi reports on public opinion and what people knew about the Jews, that there was open talk very early on about the mass deportations. So they started in November 1941, and in places in Western Germany, people are talking within a week or 2 weeks about what happened to the Jews from their neighborhoods who were deported to Minsk, and how they were taken as far as Warsaw by passenger trains and then loaded into cattle trucks, and that people were sorted out between those who could work and those who couldn't work, and that everybody in the latter category was shot. So there's a huge amount of information that's traveling back through all kinds of sources from the Eastern Front, especially in the phase in 1941-42 of mass shooting, because mass shooting is not hidden away behind high security fences in isolated death camps. It's taking place in front of hundreds of thousands or millions of witnesses. And those people don't necessarily write home about it. They might write in diaries sometimes, but they talk a lot. And they talk to each other. They talk on trains when they're coming home on leave. And there are increasing reports coming up through 1942, as the Holocaust reaches its height, of the information swirling around in Germany. And people from local party branches start writing in to the central party organizers, so to Martin Bormann, asking, well, what are we meant to do? How do we deny these terrible atrocity rumors? And Bormann's reply in late 1942 is absolutely astonishing. He says, oh, no, don't deny it. Tell people that this was something we really had to do, and this was the best time to do it. And so there is this open secret, which is not being publicly talked about. And Goebbels plays a very, very careful media control game where he tries to keep actual details of deportations and specific places out of the press. And yet it's awash with Hitler's threats in an abstract global sense about annihilating Jews across Europe in the case of a world war. And it's very clear they are in a world war after the declaration of war on the United States in December 1941. And so even when Himmler tells the Nazi leadership in October 1943 that this is their secret, it's their thing, and the rest of the German people isn't really meant to know about it, he's very aware that that's not true. and that actually through the whole summer of 1943, people were talking endlessly in public about the relationship between the Allied bombing of German cities and the murder of the Jews. And they're talking about it at that point in public in a way that they didn't the year before, because for once Goebbels puts it in the public domain by calling the bombing not just terror bombing, but Jewish terror bombing. He tries to mobilize radical anti-Semitic feeling and to tell Germans that they are the victims of the Jews and that the Jews are fighting a war of extermination against the Germans. And, you know, he's talked to Goering about this in the immediate aftermath of the defeat at Stalingrad in March 1943. And he says, you know, it's not a bad thing if the German people know what we've done, because if they know that we've burnt all our bridges, then they'll fight harder. And actually what comes back is different. What comes back to them is an acceptance that this is Jewish terror bombing when it's the targets of German civilians in cities. But the first reaction is, oh, we made a terrible mistake. We brought this on ourselves. And people are very critical of it. As Katya was saying, they also have a link back to the burning of synagogues in Kristallnacht in November 1938. And of course, there are sort of symbolic and visual symbols here. So, you know, the fires of 1938 are then bigger when incendiary bombs are thrown down onto German cities and opening up housing blocks. But even more so, quite a lot of the bunkers in cities are built on the public land where synagogues had stood. And so there's a direct connection in people's heads between air raid defense and their attack on the Jews. And the interesting thing is, this is the first occasion that people don't say, we're retaliating against the Jews. They're saying, we did it first. We're the guilty ones. And it's a profound mood of pessimism through that summer, which culminates in the firebombing of Hamburg, which unleashes a firestorm and kills the highest number of civilians in any Allied air raid in Europe. And through that summer until the autumn, there is this wash of public discussion about German responsibility for provoking Allied air raids, the need to find a way out of it, and the prospect that they might even have regime change, because Italy has managed to do this. The day that the firestorm breaks out in Hamburg is also the first, is the day on which Mussolini is deposed in Italy. And for that brief period until September 1943, there's a lot of talk about regime change and also a lot of catastrophizing of how badly the war is going and how quickly they're having to retreat on the Eastern Front and how rapidly the Allies might advance on the Italian peninsula. And by the time Italy capitulates and ceases being a German ally altogether in September 1943, it stops. Himmler, over the previous 2 months, has told the German police and the Gestapo to pull back and not to arrest people for saying these sorts of things. By the time he talks to the German, to the Nazi leadership in Posen in October 1943, that's over, and he started doing a series of exemplary punishments to tell people where the limits of this kind of speech are, and the sort of defeatist comments that have talked about the Holocaust and talked about the bombing war through that summer are off limits. And that's carefully orchestrated to fit the stabilization of the military situation. So from September 43, they're in command of most of the Italian peninsula. They've also stabilized the Eastern Front on the Dnieper River. And it's then a different mood music. And they start doing mass evacuations and changing the character of civil defense in Germany to make people feel safer. So it's like a dictatorship which really tottered for a couple of months in the summer and really wasn't sure whether this mass strategic bombing offensive that starts in March 43 will actually have a devastating effect on German morale and on the Nazi regime. So they're really not certain. They're very cautious. And in that vacuum, all the things that people have known about in 41 and 42 and talked about in private, but not in public, they all suddenly become public. And that's extraordinary. And it doesn't go away. And it comes back each time that the situation gets more difficult after that.
It also shows the power of propaganda, because when you have a state official regime dehumanizing a people and spreading and injecting such poison into it, that we see it around the world today. People's minds get twisted and warped, and terrible atrocities happen as a result.
Yes, and yet it isn't just brainwashing. And that's one of the really interesting tests. It is dialogic. It is a regime which is pumping out these messages, and every week it's getting reports back on what people said about them. And there's some occasions, quite surprising, where they just don't work. So we're now in the anniversary of the Dambuster raids, this thing that the Royal Air Force was terribly proud of, because it wasn't about bombing cities, it was about destroying the dams in the Ruhr. And without really thinking about it, German propaganda says, oh, that's Jewish terror bombing. And even in the Ruhr, where thousands of people die in the floodwaters that are unleashed, it's immediately rejected. And people say, what are you talking about? What's this got to do with Jews? What's this about terror? This is a legitimate strategic target. It's an incredibly prestigious thing for them to have done. If our guys haven't ever thought about doing it back to them, then, you know, maybe we should refund their tuition costs. I mean, they're incredibly ironic and bitter about it. But they're bitter against their own regime for having failed either to do this or to prevent it. But what they also say is this is not Jewish terror bombing. And so you can see that the connection between Jews and terror is the idea that this is exterminatory, and therefore it's when major population centers are targeted that it makes sense. And it's worth thinking, you know, well, what are the Allies trying to do? Well, in private, Churchill also talks about terror bombing. He's just incredibly careful not to ever put it in the media because he knows the effect it will have. And there is a briefing after the raids on Dresden in February 1945 where the word terror bombing is used in public by accident by one of the British spokesmen. And it produces an uproar and it produces a parliamentary debate, which more or less forces Churchill to distance himself from strategic bombing altogether. And he hangs sort of Harris out to dry and just says, well, it's nothing really to do with me. It's terribly opportunistic, but it tells you some of the moral sensibilities on both sides around indiscriminate attacks on civilian targets. What would now be counted not only as a war crime, but probably as one of the hallmarks of genocide. And so we do have to think about this as a genocidal war in which, by today's standards, there are multiple markers of genocide, from blockade, mass starvation of Soviet cities, the starving to death of 3 million Soviet POWs by the end of the first 6 months of the war in the Soviet Union, long before we get to death camps. And so our standards today under international law of what counts as genocide and how we think about the Second World War as being genocidal are not the same as standards of that time. I think people are very aware that these are crimes against humanity. I mean, a number of the diarists I explored in my book, The German War, have very profound religious sensibilities where they are worried about the war crimes that the Wehrmacht is carrying out in Poland from 1939 onwards, and even more the SS and police organizations behind the lines, and saying we will be punished for this, and worrying that they're some sort of shield protecting these war crimes being committed in their rear. And yet the same people feel it's their patriotic duty to go on fighting the war. And that's, I think, just to come back to this portal and people finding out now about their Nazi relatives, one of the most interesting things that's bubbling up is the dates in which people join the party. The people who join on the outbreak of war or during the course of the war or even really quite close to its end. So the legendary founding director of the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich, Martin Brorschardt, turned out to have joined the Nazi party in October 1944. Very late, but actually makes perfect sense if you're a young patriotic German who decides you have to stand up and be counted in the Reich's last most important hour of national defense when they're fighting on their own borders. And so they're now having to ask themselves these really awkward questions about what was the relationship between this war and its apparent legitimacy within Germany and this increasing knowledge that they're fighting it in a genocidal way and that they're doing things which they can't defend morally, and yet at some level the greater moral failure for them would be to lose. And I think that dilemma of thinking that you're in a zero-sum game where either way you're not going to come out well is really important for radicalizing people. And I think that's something that's still very, very relevant in the world today, that if you put people in this pressure cooker where they're so frightened about what will come back to them if they lose not one, but a second world war, I mean, they've lost one already, then it's easier and easier to mobilize people around patriotic notions of national defense.
Well, tonight we are talking about the rise of the Nazi regime and how it took hold in Germany. When we come back, we'll be finding out about that new search engine that Nick has mentioned. It's an engine that allows users to search Nazi party records to find out whether their ancestors were card-carrying members. And we're going to find out more about that and indeed what was happening in Weimar right after this break. Welcome back. We're talking about the rise of the Nazis and how they took hold in Germany. My brilliant panel of experts, Professor Nick Stargardt, is Professor of Modern European History at the University of Oxford and is a fellow at Magdalen College there. He's one of the world's leading experts on Nazi Germany, and his books include Witnesses of War and The German War, A Nation Under Arms. Also delighted to be rejoined by Katja Hoyer, who's an historian journalist, visiting research fellow at King's College London and fellow of the Royal Historical Society. And her wonderful new book, Weimar, Life on the Edge of Catastrophe, examines the people, politics and culture of the city that gave its name to Germany's first democracy and later became a centre of Nazi power. And Katja, let's maybe talk about some of the people in Weimar during this period, because what's really interesting is the way you see an incredible cast of characters where there's fascists alongside socialists, there's artists, there's workers, there's politicians and citizens. And in the way that Weimar almost acts as a laboratory or an incubator for the Nazi regime, that it's a place where you have a gathering of people with wildly different backgrounds and belief systems.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do say at the beginning of the book that I don't want them to be understood as types because they're not. I mean, Weimar isn't a sort of cross-section, a mini cross-section of German society. Quite on the contrary, it is a special place because of that cultural legacy that I mentioned earlier. It's very middle class, very sort of conservative in its social outlook. But what I was looking for was a group of people who sort of represent different ways of reacting to what's going on around them, and who have different forms and types of agency. So say, for example, one of the people in my book is Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche, who's the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche's sister. And her brother died in 1900, and she's effectively looking after his literary remains. And she's got a choice now when the Nazis basically come to town and are wondering whether they can use Nietzsche's philosophy as a sort of means of saying that their movement has got deeper philosophical roots than you know, the post-war era. She can decide whether to basically hand them Nietzsche, since she's got all of his works and is sort of the guardian of his legacy, or whether she decides to go into the public and say, no, this isn't right, you know, and he meant something completely different. That's a very different form of agency to, say, a doctor who decides whether to carry out, sort of Nazi ideology in his practice, or a teacher who may decide that in the 1920s she hadn't set out to teach eugenics. You know, what do you do in the 1930s when that sets in? So that's why I sort of chose a group of people who, in a way, represent different ways of reacting to what was going on around them.
And Katja, I can't understand how the Nazis in Weimar went from being seen as maybe vandals in 1926, or certainly kind of troublemakers, to performing so well in 1929. Because when there is that major congress in July in 1926, there are problems there with it. It's not a huge gathering. It's a big, but it's not massive. And I wonder, how quickly they were able to take hold.
Yeah, no, that is a good example, actually. So this is the first formal Nazi Party rally before the more famous ones later on take place in Nuremberg. So this is in Weimar in 1926. It's the very first one after Hitler comes out of prison. What's interesting about that is, as you say, it's not huge. So they reckon about 6,000-7,000 people took part in it in a town of about 35,000 people. And most of these people that come to it are external, out from outside of Weimar. They get called in by the party. So at this point, nobody's got any pragmatic reason really to take part in it, because they're not in power. You know, nothing is going to happen to you if you don't take part in it. There's no fear element here. So a lot of Weimarers simply observe this and see it unfold. And it's incredibly violent as an event. So they gather in Weimar to set up really the movement's future. So things like the Hitler Youth, for example, gets its name at that convention. They try out rituals like the Hitler salute in public for the first time to see if people would even respond to it, that kind of thing. But nonetheless, there's violence right from the beginning there. So you have, brawls, you have really violent street battles. At the train station, you have people stabbing each other with knives and daggers. A policeman is shot on the open street and nearly dies, sort of bleeds out on the pavement in front of a hotel in the train station. And Weimarers are shell-shocked by this. There's a town council meeting afterwards where they all decide they'll never have the Nazis back again. The mayor says something like they came as guests and this is how they behave. It's appalling. And just a few weeks later, you get them back in and Hitler again, speaks in the very theatre where the Republic was founded in 1919. So again, I think it shows something about how that time is first of all infused by violence, and people are more, I think, well, not used to it, but they're certainly, because of the First World War, there is a higher degree of violence overall in politics and in public life. If we think our parliamentary debates are raucous these days, at the time you get people virtually hitting each other with chairs, people's kneecaps being broken in parliament. I have one incident in the local parliament where somebody throws an ink pot at somebody else's head, and it's just incredibly violent anyway. But even on that scale, the Nazi movement, is particularly extreme, and conservatives at the time are still put off by that. So you do get people like Elisabeth Fürst and Nietzsche, for example, who is staunchly conservative and nationalist, but she's appalled by the violence and thinks that the Nazi movement is too crude and too brutal. And that changes later on. And I think a huge driving factor behind that is the economic crisis that sets in after the Wall Street crash in 1929. And you see the levels of despair going up and people almost kind of ignoring the violence. And even at times you see people's comments along the lines of, Hitler's going to sort this out. They believe that this is a kind of unfortunate side effect rather than a feature of Nazism. So you get people saying things like, oh, if only the Führer knew, kind of thinking that Hitler is going to get a grip on this. Even the military, they basically say to Hitler when he takes over that they're happy to work with him so long as he gets the SA, the private army, the stormtroopers, under control because they're so violent. So I think people still almost deceive themselves in thinking that, this is just an early sort of quirk of the Nazi Party rather than an inherent feature of its regime.
And by 1929, in those elections, the Nazis do better in Weimar than they do in neighbouring areas, and it allows them to get a foothold into government.
Yeah, that's 1928. It's the last election before the Wall Street crash, and you do see higher numbers in Weimar, but still comparatively low. I mean, this is really interesting that nationwide they only get a 2.6% in that election, despite the fact that all the other factors that will later make them successful, so the propaganda, Hitler's own personal charisma, all these things are basically already in place, and yet they're not getting anywhere really. But you do see the first Nazi minister being appointed in Weimar in 1930. So 3 years before the Nazi Party come into power nationwide. There is higher support from the beginning. Partially that's due to the social demographic I mentioned earlier. So basically Weimar is very, very middle class. And those social strata are overrepresented in the in the Nazi voter spectrum in 1933 as well. People always think it's the 6 million unemployed who go and vote for the Nazis, and some of them do, but a lot of them stick with the communists and the socialists and the social democrats because they're workers and they're sort of, you know, they tend to lean towards the left. Whilst really it's the lower and middle classes who are worried about what those unemployed workers will do, who go to the Nazis as a supposed sort of bulwark against communism. And that's why you see from the beginning a sort of over-representation in Weimar specifically towards the Nazi party. And in 1930, that first coalition is basically at the regional level, is one of the states, the state of Thuringia, of which Weimar is the capital, where you get the first Nazi minister. And not, it's not anyone either. It's Wilhelm Frick, who is one of the most extreme sort of early Nazi members and a very close associate of Adolf Hitler's. And he later on becomes the Minister of the Interior. So Hitler even takes it that seriously that he parachutes one of his most important figures into that government to have an early sort of testing field, really, of Nazi ideas and of how far they can go in Weimar and in that state of Thuringia.
Nick, can we talk about this new search engine? Because I think it offers an invaluable way of checking if family members or people have been members, were members of the Nazi Party. But I'd say there's probably a terrifying dimension as well, because it could completely upend a family history where people might have been told one particular version of their family story, and now they can discover something quite different.
Yes, I think what's interesting about it is that it's coming now. And as Katya says, it's incredibly correlated to social class. It's positively correlated to people being middle class. And for that reason, I think it's a much more popular dictatorship and obsessed with its popularity than its Soviet counterpart, because they can draw on the enthusiasms of professionals who can start to self-fashion and define what they think Nazism is in the 1930s in ways which aren't necessarily what the regime sees Nazism as, but the regime is very elastic about its positive goals. Its negative goals are very, very clear. I mean, it's going to terrorize communists. It's later going to terrorize Jews. It's going to focus on asocials. It's going to, as which becomes a catch-all for everybody from the long-term unemployed to Roma. And then it's going to persecute the disabled. But what's interesting is that by the time the threat of lawless violence of the stormtroopers is curtailed in the purge of June 1934, you also have a turning down of mass terror against the left and the German working class and the socialist and communist labor movement. And from that point onwards, within Germany, the foci of persecution are minorities. And that switch from trying to win the social majority to focusing your enemies as being minorities and small minorities is, I think, part of what allows the regime to appear both relatively peaceable and incredibly powerful. I mean, it's quite different if you're trying to convert the half of the electorate which never voted for you, which is their idea in 1933-34. And I think that switch from the lawless terror that Katya was describing for 1926-29 and up to the rise to power, it switches into this more organized forms of terror as the wild concentration camps of the stormtroopers are handed over to the concentration camps run by the SS. And they nearly closed them in the summer of 34. The number of prisoners have dropped from something over 100,000 at their peak to under 5,000, but they don't close them. And this campaign against what are called asocials keeps it going. And then from 38, of course, there's a mass influx of Jews. And from 39, increasingly, it will be non-Germans. It will be Poles. It will be prisoners of war who don't do what they're told. It will be forced foreign laborers who fall out with their employers. It will be a whole series of other categories of people who will become the camp prisoners through the war years.
I always loved the Philip Kerr, Bernie Gunther novels, and the very first one is called March Violets, the name given to those opportunists who joined the Nazi Party after they took power in 1933. And I wonder, is there something that you can see in when people join? I know there's complex and complicated reasons, and it's hard to gauge people's motivations and whether it's genuine or whether it's opportunistic or whether it's for other reasons, but when looking at when people joined, is that significant?
Yes. So the March Fallen, the Märzgefallen, is of course both an allusion and a pun. So it means all the enthusiasts who fell upon the party, but it also means the people who led the Berlin Revolution of March 1848, who were shot down. And so there is, in fact, a Republican revolutionary myth around the March Fallen of 1848, which the Nazis are playing with when they're saying, well, we've been overwhelmed by these opportunistic enthusiasts. And the historiography, as it developed in the 1970s and 80s, focused a lot on the secondary reasons why people joined the party or thought that Hitler was fantastic, which were he brought full employment after the Great Depression. Everything was going their way. They were able to revise the Treaty of Versailles without firing a bullet and regain the Rhineland and the Saarland and then even the Sudetenland off Czechoslovakia. And so there are all of these reasons why, in a secondary sense, you might think you identify not with the regime directly, but at least with the things which have been good for you. And that's really been superseded in the last 20 years by people going back and looking at, well, what do people actually say? You know, not if we speculate about it, but what happens if we start reading their private letters and diaries? And what's very, very striking is the ways in which people positively identify with Nazi Germany as a project and start fashioning themselves as Nazis. And this is even stronger during the war, I would argue, because the war is cast, as the First World War was, as a war of national defense, where it's Britain and France which declare war on Germany on the 3rd of November, September 1939. Germany doesn't declare a war on them. Invasion of Poland on the 1st of September is seen as a defensive police action to defend the rights of ethnic Germans in Poland. And so for Germans, actually, it's the 3rd of September, which is the date in their diaries as the start of the war. And every single act of war is cast as a defensive action. The invasion of neutral countries, Norway, is seen as protecting their neutrality against the British mining their territorial waters illegally. Churchill actually is the first Lord of the Admiralty, canvassed it publicly in the House of Commons. So for every act of invasion, there's some defense. Even the act of invading the Soviet Union, for which there's no warning, there's no preparation psychologically, is sold to the German people as being a preventive strike, a preemptive action, because the Soviets are about to invade across the demarcation line in Poland. And it's much better, obviously, if Germany fights forward defense off its own territory. And this is firmly believed by even very respectable West German historians into the 1950s and simply taken as if it is true until they're really challenged over it. And so the debates post-war, unpicking a Nazi interpretation of what has become history, but at the time was there present, are very, very hard to dislodge. And those buy-in moments make you realize that we need to understand their versions of common sense, because they're not the kind of way that we would make sense of it.
Well, tonight we are talking about the rise to power of the Nazis and how they took over Germany in the 1930s. And we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring some of these questions and whether it's too simplistic to divide the Nazis into and the Germans into perpetrators, victims and resistors. And we'll discuss this and more after the break. Welcome back. Tonight we are talking about the Nazis. My panel of experts, Professor Nick Stargardt, Professor of Modern European History at the University of Oxford, and Katia Hoyer, an historian, journalist and visiting research fellow at King's College London. Nick, moving away from simplistic approaches and how we should maybe view those who get caught up in this regime and commit terrible atrocities. In the past, have we been too simplistic in viewing Germans as perpetrators, victims or resistors, and that it's more morally complicated than that?
Yes, I mean, I think it's inevitable that we focus first on the perpetrators because the crimes are so extraordinary. And it isn't really until the early 1990s, 30 years ago, that we get really good scholarship about who were the perpetrators at an ordinary low level. And we have this extraordinary double investigation of part-time reserve policemen from Hamburg, which becomes a debate between two important historians, Daniel Goldhagen and Chris Browning. And from that moment of, I think, global Holocaust awareness, it's the same time as Schindler's List is screened, there is an intense scrutiny about really nitty-gritty granularity of who was doing what, why were they doing it, what was their motivation, were they bound together as little primary groups, as military historians had thought. And you realize that there's been nothing like that. The wave of early scholarship on Nazi Germany and biographies of Hitler written in the early 70s, none of them thought the Holocaust was important. And so all of that earlier historiography, which stressed social class, which saw the collapse of Weimar as a left-right conflict, which in many ways it was, wasn't very adjustable to thinking about what the Nazis actually set out to do. And as the focus shifted towards seeing this as a racial state with an obsession with eugenics, so they had to take people's buy-in, their often professional or non-Nazi motivations for doing these things, much more seriously. That becomes a much messier story, and you realize that none of it would have been possible without a very wide social alliance, first behind the war effort, but then secondly of German elites carrying out a similar sort of thought experiment of, well, we lost the First World War because we just weren't ruthless enough. They all accept that they're going to be the inferior power in terms of raw materials and resources and strategic ability to hold out in a long-term war. Everybody realizes this, and they realize it from the stranglehold of the Allied blockade in the First World War, and they know that they'll face a similar blockade in the Second World War. So everything they do, from thinking we have to clamp down on pacifists or defeatists on the home front, we can't allow Jehovah's Witnesses not to serve in the Wehrmacht. And everywhere you look, it's as if not just the Nazis, but German professionals and elites are girding themselves to be more ruthless and to do more than they'd already done in 1914 to 18. And so it's a little bit similar to 1933, where you again have this broad alliance of conservative nationalists and Nazis thinking that they're going to save Germany from the perils of parliamentary democracy and liberalism and the left. Except after 39, it's a much wider coalition. It's much more like the First World War coalition, where everybody who isn't a revolutionary anti-Nazi, a still radical communist, actually in some way participates in this war effort and thinks we again have to have a united front, as German parties had talked about in the First World War. And so, in fact, the first usage of that term, national community, Volksgemeinschaft, which the Nazis make their own, is in the First World War. It's used by all of the parties to the First World War coalition politics to describe what they're doing, that they are supporting a nation under siege and they will commit themselves. And I think it's that area which then becomes very, very interesting for thinking about how people radicalize themselves, how they, as the war unfolds and as it develops in ways they hadn't predicted, and their expectations are falsified and they have to rethink, well, what do we have to do to win this war? All of those things act as engines of self-radicalization. And it's the point where by May 1944, you have ordinary German civilians writing into the propaganda ministry, commenting on the erection of a ghetto in Budapest. The Germans occupy Hungary. Hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews in the region of the capital are herded into a ghetto. And of course, we know, and they should have known, that this was an antechamber to deportation to Auschwitz. But that's not how they write about it. What they say is, oh, wow, they found the perfect scheme for air raid defense because the Allies are not going to bomb a Jewish concentration of population. In other words, these people act as human shields. Why didn't we do this in German cities? We'd be so much better off.
Katja, I'm going to leave the final word with you. And I wonder, what would you see as the message for us from studying Weimar and the message for today in terms of what democratic institutions need to do in order to survive?
Well, I'm quite careful not to draw sort of huge comparisons there because I think it's been done a lot recently that people sort of just point to this time and then say, because this happened, you know, in Germany during or before the Nazi era, so now we must do X, because I think as we've just explored, they were very different times. Yeah, so where I do see lessons to be drawn there is in patterns and in people's behaviour, because what I noticed is what Nick just alluded to as well, this kind of gradual escalation of things and this getting used to quite extraordinary circumstances and people adapting to that by radicalizing themselves. So when I look at Karl there, my ordinary, you know, shop owner in Weimar, he looks at something like Kristallnacht, the pogroms in 1938, and finds them appalling. And yet he doesn't respond to it. He carries on even after there's a concentration camp built sort of on his doorstep, you know, moving around in its vicinity, carrying on hiking and sledging up there with his young son. At one point, he writes in his diary, you know, that hiking isn't any fun anymore up there because of that stupid concentration camp, you know, meaning that basically because of all the hiking paths had been blocked off, that it's not as relaxing anymore going up there. And I think that there's a lesson in that, basically, where people, when they're faced with crises or with challenging circumstances, that they tend to withdraw into themselves, into the private sphere, and look away. Every time huge, you know, political events happen in Weimar, he just goes on the train, leaves Weimar during that time, and goes hiking, trying to forget about it. And that's, I think, the voids that begin to exist when you do that lead to further radicalization, because effectively politics can seep into them. And when there's no resistance, and the Nazis do try, and with each step, basically, they look very carefully at how people respond to what they're doing. They escalate things bit by bit. It's hard to imagine, you know, in 1933 that people would have just got used to the idea of a concentration camp on that scale. Never mind of the war and the Holocaust, but it is a gradual escalation, and there's a lesson in that, I think, to engage with what's going on around us and to respond accordingly.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to Professor Nick Stargardt and Katja Hoyer. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.